Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Mejlis and author of the Central Asia in Focus newsletter. The topic of Russia's historical legacy in Central Asia has increasingly come under review in Central Asia since Russia launched its full-scale war in Ukraine. Many Russians, especially Russian officials, like to claim, in some cases insist, that Russia's colonization of Central Asia was beneficial to the region. A growing number of people in Central Asia have a different view of the years under Russian and then Soviet colonization, and it's generated discussion throughout Central Asia about how the years under Russian rule should be assessed and what Central Asia's relationship with Russia should be going forward. To discuss all this, I am joined by Diana Kudaibergen, a political sociologist from Cambridge University who will be moving to the University College of London this autumn. And I'll mention that Diana is from Kazakhstan. Erica Marat, professor of political science at the National Defense University in Washington and a Central Asian expert, of course. Azamat Junisbai, sociologist and professor at Pitzer College in Claremont, California. Thank you all for joining me. And let me add that our distinguished guests have authored some books on Central Asia, so please look them up on the internet if you have the chance. Diana, I want to start with you. Tell us, you know, we did this show a couple years ago about the decolonial discourse and where it was going, but obviously much has changed. I know that you're closely involved with this. What have you seen recently in the last year that shows the direction that this conversation is going in?
Thank you for having me. I'm really glad to be here and join this conversation. I think I've seen a lot. I've been part of another podcast called Adikalon, produced by my colleagues from Kyrgyzstan, but it's a collaborative project between sort of communities in northern Eurasia, the people from Sakha Republic, from Tuva, from Buryatia, and other places, and Central Asians. So mainly from Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, but we're also involving people from Uzbekistan and Tajikistan right now as well. And what I've seen in these conversations is that, you know, this idea of Russian colonialism and how it was detrimental to all of our cultures, but in different, you know, timescales and different aspects, is really going on in these kind of like trans-border, transnational perspectives. That's a very interesting conversation that's been ongoing. And of course, I think the whole idea of sort of considering Russian colonial rule or any other colonial rule beneficial, in quotation marks, to any nation, I think is quite a, you know, sinister consideration, sinister category to put forward. So we're discussing that. Our podcasts are now available in Russian, so we're discussing them on YouTube. And this issue of language, that, you know, something is very important, because we also made podcasts recently in Kyrgyz and Kazakh language, where, for example, somebody would speak Kyrgyz and the person would respond in Kazakh, and we're trying to find synergy there. And we're also launching this fall, we're launching a podcast in English. But this idea of language, I think, is something that came up as a hot topic. Is like, you know, can we decolonize Russian? What are we going to do with this kind of legacy? There are a lot of people, not only in Central Asia, but also in Northern Eurasia, who don't speak their own native languages precisely because of Russian colonization. So what do we do with this issue of language? I think is one of the hottest topics I've seen right now in all of these discussions, and how people respond to the type of discussions and dialogues we have in this language.
Mm-hmm. Erica, could you pick up on that point too? I know you and I have had some discussions over Twitter about the use of language and how they're trying to move toward the priority on the local language, the Republican language of the country. You know, in Kyrgyzstan, of course, this, when they decided they were going to make all the put all the documents in Kyrgyz language, and you're from Kyrgyzstan originally, when they decided they were going to put all the documents and all the official records in Kyrgyz, the Russian foreign ministry pushed back on that and claimed that it was discrimination. How is the transition from Russian to Kyrgyz or other languages, native languages in Central Asia, going, in your opinion?
Mm-hmm. I think the language issue is especially acute for Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, and also North Asian republics that are within Russia, because we were colonized especially brutally and erased especially brutally, Russified. And there is obviously a new interest in learning languages in Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and republics among indigenous peoples in Russia, their own native languages, or at least learning about what has been forgotten with forgetting languages, you know, what kind of literature, cultural parts of their heritage has been forgotten. So there is a renewed interest. It obviously requires resources. It can't be just enthusiasm. And Kazakhstan has been a lot more resourceful in that sense and producing more literature in the Kazakh language and encouraging learning of Kazakh in general. Kyrgyzstan does not have that many resources, but there are lots of grassroots initiatives in helping those who are interested to learn Kyrgyz language. And I think the trend is more and more families in urban areas are now trying to teach their children Kyrgyz language. When it comes to discussing decolonial ideas in the Russian language, I think that if we look at language as a means of communication and not necessarily politicized medium, I think it doesn't really matter in what language we discuss. Very often, we obviously rotate between Russian, English, or indigenous languages. And I think the more important is to be able to communicate, exchange ideas, generate new ideas, new consciousness, decolonial consciousness, debate some of the terminology even in Russian language that we took for granted, but now we want to move away from it. I think by discussing decolonialism in Russian, we are decolonizing Russian language as well. And as one of my Ukrainian students told me recently when we were discussing Russian invasion in the Russian language, he says that it's okay to use the tool of the colonizer against the colonizer. So that's where I stand at this point.
Interesting point. Asamada, you've been on social networks talking about the decolonial process and the roots of the colonization in Russia, too. How do you see the decolonial process progressing in Central Asia now? It's 2.5 years since the invasion of Ukraine. What do you see that's new that you didn't expect to see?
Hi, Bruce. Thank you, first of all, for so much for having me. I've been thinking recently a lot about the results of the study I conducted last summer. I basically organized 40 interviews with ethnic Kazakhs, specifically in Almaty, and wanted to know how, people thought about the Soviet period, how they assessed the Soviet period, what they thought of the language of colonization and decolonization and whatnot. And I wanted specifically to see if it made a difference for ethnic Kazakhs, what language they actually used in daily life, what language they consume news in. And so of these 40 interviews, half were done with people who used Kazakh, right, to consume news and information, to communicate with their loved ones. Basically, they are Kazakh speakers, right? Russian is a language that most everyone in Kazakhstan, can use to some extent or fully, but for them, Kazakh was their first language. And then the other half, the other 20 people, we did interviews with ethnic Kazakhs who are Russian speakers, like my family, right? So basically people who are using Russian in sort of every aspect of their lives. And then further within each of these groups, we looked at half of the folks. So out of the 20 people, out of the 20, 10 were people who were under 30, right? So people who were just there during the post-Soviet period, right? So independence after 1991, right? And then the other group that we wanted to look at specifically was people who were, 50 years and older. The idea there that they came of age during the Soviet period, right, still, and socialization and schooling and education and everything that impacted them. So as a result, you have four groups, right? You have older Kazakh-speaking folks, younger Kazakh-speaking folks, older Russian-speaking folks, and younger Russian-speaking folks. And the patterns are quite fascinating. What it appears that people who use Kazakh, who basically are immersed in Kazakh in their everyday lives, who learn about the world through Kazakh, they are far more critical of the Soviet period, of the Soviet legacy, of they embrace the word, yes, it was colonialism. They say, yes, it was a colonial rule, right? So those things, they're there already, at least the ones that we were able to talk to. But interestingly, that's true for both young and old, right? And talking about colonialism, it was interesting. In both groups, the young and old Kazakh-speaking Kazakhs, they used that phrase. They said, oh, you know, our parents used to say, if your friend is Russian, you better keep an axe nearby, right? And then if you look at the responses from the folks who are Kazakh but are Russian speakers, generation makes a big difference, right? So you have people who are young, right, 30 and under, 18 to 30-year-olds in our interviews, they actually are quite critical of the Soviet period. And this discourse, the narrative, oh, it was modernization, they, you know, built us roads and hospitals, that really wasn't as present as I'd expected. They talked about the famine, they talked about the environmental devastation of the Soviet rule, loss of language, destruction of intelligentsia, all the things that, you know, I was hoping to hear, but didn't really know if it was going to happen or not. And the group that really actually was most open or vulnerable to sort of the current Russian narratives or this, you know, the tropes about beneficial colonization were the older Russian-speaking Kazakhs, right? And the pattern was really quite distinct. So I am planning to dig a little bit deeper into some of these patterns and, you know, hopefully figure things out. But the most apparent thing is that the patterns of media consumption seem really, really different for these folks, right? So the young respondents, the ones who are under 30, they say they don't often even have televisions, or if they have television, they don't watch TV in the same way that the 50 plus folks do, right? And so a lot of the Russian channels, a lot of the Russian narratives that, you know, the television is the source of, they simply are not getting those things, right? And then for older folks, they watch TV, but if you watch TV in Kazakh only, a lot of this Russian venom stuff just does go over your head, right? It doesn't even have a shield against it. So the only group that genuinely seemed really vulnerable to the Russian narratives was the Russian-speaking older folks. I think that's what I wanted to share at this point.
Real quick, let me follow up with that. Do you see a shift in media pattern in Kazakhstan? I mean, is Kazakh language media becoming more popular, gaining more followers?
Oh, I think so. I think it reflects demographic changes. It's for me, the change is quite stark just because, you know, when I am able to visit home and, you know, spend time at my mom's place, I turn on the TV and it's unmistakable that the amount of content that is in Kazakh language, even on television, is much, much greater than it used to be. I mean, I still remember many years ago, early 2000s, where they had to mandate, right, that at least 50% of the content had to be in Kazakh, and they would try and stick Kazakh language programs in, you know, early in the morning or at night where no one would watch, but they would say, oh, we satisfied the quota. The broadcasters did. But that's clearly changing, right? So Kazakh language content on Kazakh channels is far more prominent than it has been.
Diana, I'd like to get your thoughts on that too. Is there a shift in language in the media? And I was remembering when I was in Kazakhstan just a few years ago, I was sitting in my hotel room waiting for something, and they had a soap opera on that was produced in Kazakhstan. And I was fascinated because it was both, it had Russian, ethnic Russian people and ethnic Kazakh people, and they were mixing the languages. They went back and forth. They were speaking some Kazakh, they were speaking some Russian. Is Kazakh becoming more dominant, or are they sort of moving into this by striking a balance?
Yeah, I want to second what Azamat was saying, and this is a fascinating study that I want to hear about more. But what I've been seeing more and more in the past, I don't know, decade or so, and especially with the invasion in 2022, is that there's a grassroots shift. Like, you know, people are no longer forced to speak the language or to learn the language, you know, like it used to do in the obligatory schooling or when applying for certain jobs. I think it became kind of like a more of a grassroots movement because the language content is becoming more popular. It's much cooler. There's like a whole, I mean, everybody talks about the new wave in Kazakh music. Kazakh rap is of course, I mean, I think it was always popular even when I was younger and when I was a teenager. Kazakh rap had, you know, it occupied its own niche and it was always mixing the languages, it was always bilingual in a very fluid and in a very interesting way. But what we're seeing now is kind of like this trend became the coolness of Kazakh language became a much bigger trend that occupies a lot of different spaces where you didn't see it before. You know, especially again in media, in not only in state media, but also in these independent circles, we see a whole surge of, again, particularly in Kazakhstan, decolonial thought is developing very much in this artistic kind of like cultural circles. So you see the whole wave of decolonial feminist filmmakers. Right now we have a number of fantastic festivals, cinema film festivals going on in Kazakhstan. One of them is Kızgaraz, so it's a feminist film festival organized by Malika Muhammadjan, who's a young Kazakh director. And I think she belongs to this group of people. They're much older than just the Nazarbayev generation. They, you know, the post-independence generation, we could call them like that. And these are the people for whom speaking Kazakh, Russian, and English, but mostly Kazakh, is not just like, you know, some sort of obligation. It's a very natural, it's a very cool way of producing and cool way of coexisting. And I think they're taking over even such colonial spaces as Almaty. And I will never stop saying that Almaty is a very colonial city. And people who come to Almaty and only see Kazakhstan through the lens of Almaty, that is very Russified, that is very urbanized, that, you know, has these kind of like imperial distinctions of people from the village and people from the city, more civilized, less civilized, blah, blah, blah. If you see Kazakhstan only through the lens of Almaty, I think it's a little bit not only narrow, but it's also wrong, because Almaty represents itself. And then even Almaty is changing. We see a lot more, again, Kazakh is becoming cooler, even in spaces that never wanted to, you know, to acknowledge it as a great and cool language. But then if you go beyond Almaty, if you go beyond even Astana, you see that in the regions, in these, you know, in places like Mangustau, for example, where I was on this trip, Kazakh was never, you know, it was always the language of communication, and people never perceive it as something that all of a sudden we have to pick up and speak now because of the invasion or because of the colonial war that Russia is doing in Ukraine. It was always the way of, you know, cultural communication. And I think it's a, people always talk that Mangustau Kazakh is different. I think it is, but it's also a very natural and organic way of bringing it out. And actually, when I was in Zhanaozian, I rarely heard anybody speaking Russian, not even mixing. It was very, very refreshing just to speak Kazakh on a daily basis. So I think it's changing, but I think the strength of decolonial activists, decolonial writers, we have a fantastic cohort of decolonial writers. Plek Rispek, one of my favorite characters in Kazakh or Central Asian scene right now, who's writing, who's producing these things as well, who's speaking fantastic Kazakh, and producing this content. I think it's very becoming very much popular, and even people who were, for example, Russified or who were Russian speakers or bilingual speakers, even they are starting to make this content in Kazakh now. And I think there was a big movement in contemporary art. One of my next books is about that, kind of a contemporary art, protest art in Central Asia. And I've seen how some of my respondents with whom we were communicating for over 10 years, they suddenly said, I just want to communicate with you in Kazakh, even though my Kazakh is going to be, you know, grammatically incorrect at times, even though I will have accent, I just want to speak in Kazakh to you. And I think that's something beautiful. But I've definitely seen the surge, you know, in these Russian-speaking communities right after 2022, the February full-scale invasion. It became kind of like a trigger for people who maybe did not use Kazakh as much in their daily lives. It became a trigger for them to slowly. But, you know, there's a double movement. There's a movement to decolonize Russia, but there's also a movement of making Kazakh more empowered and making it more public, even in spaces, as I said, that were not used to it before.
Okay, thank you. Erica, Diana just used it when she was talking about young people gravitating toward the Kazakh language, is using it. I believe you use the term that it was cool. Now, I've heard this from other people too, that there's recently speaking the local language among the young population is considered cool. Do you get that impression from other countries in Central Asia?
Yes, I do. I do. It's it is cool now to try to speak your own language, or at least to incorporate more and more features of your own language in daily communication. You know, even if Russian is your dominant language, then you still try to incorporate. I, for once, you know, I'm a thoroughly Russified person, and Kyrgyz is a dormant language for me. But whenever I go to Kyrgyzstan right now, I try to speak Kyrgyz. And I was just absolutely blown away by how I'm able to connect with different people on a different level. So especially those who don't speak Russian and only Kyrgyz. And the kind of conversations I was able to have, the kind of emotional content of our conversations is something that I've been missing out for a very long time. So it's I definitely see it happening in Kyrgyzstan as well. It is on a different scale because it's a smaller country. And again, is not as wealthy as Kazakhstan, but it's definitely happening, and there is more and more. I think aside even from language, and language is absolutely an important part, but aside from language, I think this what we see in the day to day, you know, existence of ordinary people, or, well, I don't know how to call it, you know, general population, and especially those who are Russified, what we see is this really significant shift of no longer being ashamed of own indigenous culture. So shedding this colonial narrative of indigenous cultures being backwards, inferior to Russianness or Europeanness or whatever else, and embracing it as something precious and a source of dignity, a source of joy, happiness, and shedding the embarrassment that used to be so pervasive in our societies.
Okay, great. Asma, I believe it was last year, Putin was visiting Kazakhstan, and President Tokayev came up to say some opening remarks and started speaking in Kazakh, right? And it was, and you saw all the Russian officials, Lavrov was there and other people scrambling to get the headphones, right? A lot of people read a lot of different things into that this was a nationalist statement or something. But how did you see that? I mean, was he just simply trying to promote the national language, which is in fact enshrined in the Constitution, and make the point that this is Kazakhstan? A lot of people, like I said, especially people in Russia, looked at that as kind of a rebellious way to address a Russian delegation. How did you view it?
To me, it seemed, I mean, it was only a few seconds, right? It was only a few seconds, a few sentences, but symbolically, it seemed important, right? That saying, yes, you are in a different country, right? And so, yes, this is the old colonial master, you know, but you don't begin by addressing the old colonial power, you know, using their own language. You start using your own language. And to me, it seemed like a symbolically meaningful, albeit very short, you know, thing, right? A symbolically meaningful thing to do. I've been thinking about what both Diana and Erica said, and I think there's a really interesting pattern. In Central Asia, like Diana said, right? There are, in Kazakhstan specifically, right? Or certainly in Kyrgyzstan and many places, there are many places, many communities where folks never lost their language, right? Where Russian never became their first language, where the people kept the language, people kept the culture. You know, to look at it a different way, right? Where Russian colonization sort of colonized consciousness, right? The colonization of the mind did not really succeed, right? I think where Russian colonization succeeded the most, where they advanced the farthest in terms of people's minds, right? That was sort of the comprador class, right? The Russian speaking Kyrgyz, people who did really lose the language, right? The ethnic Kazakhs who are unable to communicate in Kazakh, right? Ethnic Kyrgyz who cannot communicate in Kyrgyz. And for one, you know, if you think about it, during the Soviet period, right, this thoroughly Russified Central Asians were the sort of the I don't know, perhaps the most privileged, right? Certainly they were the ones that were sort of closest to the imperial center, right? So that was kind of you punch your ticket, right? So the price of admission to a more privileged life, perhaps, right, was total Russification for Central Asians, right? And so these are the folks, paradoxically, now that things have changed, and especially after the start of the full-scale invasion, these are the folks who actually have the most work to do and have the farthest to travel, right, in terms of language, in terms of culture, in terms of sort of reconnecting with their own people, right? Like Erica said, something was very poignant, right? Even communicating in Kyrgyz, you are able to connect with people in a way that you haven't been able to do before. And so I think for those of us, my own family included, myself included, right, who are unfortunately have lost the connection, have lost the language effectively, the decolonization, this kind of internal decolonization is definitely kind of a huge project, and it turns your world upside down. But yeah, for folks who never lost the language, for folks who are outside of this Russian sort of bubbles, right, it looks very, very different. I think disproportionately because so many academics and sort of intellectuals, nonprofit folks, they come from Russian-speaking families. So it might seem like a larger phenomenon, where in reality, like Diana said, in Mangistau, a lot of these people never lost the language, right? And more power to them. But I think for those of us that were sort of went the furthest in sort of essentially losing or rejecting even all traces of the indigenous language, indigenous culture, we're the ones that are now trying to work things out. But maybe that's also a sign that Russian colonization, in terms of people's minds, in terms of people's sort of cultures and everything, worldviews, was not as successful in Central Asia. At least it was not uniformly successful when it comes to different sets of people.
Okay, thank you. We're getting pretty close to the halfway point, but I want to come back to Erica for just a second. Sadr Japarov is the, if we exclude the Turkmen president, the current Turkmen president, Sadr Japarov is the only one of the presidents that hasn't spent half his life or more in the Soviet Union. Do you see a difference in the way that he addresses the people? I mean, obviously when he's together with Putin or when they're all together, they'll speak Russian. But do you see any distinction on the part of Japarov that you don't see in the older Central Asian leaders, Rahman, Takayev, even Mirziyoyev?
Bruce, I think this is a really interesting observation. I have not thought about it this way. But now that you mention it, absolutely, he's able to speak the language of the population that has not been Russified or as Sovietized as all the previous leaders in Central Asia and in Kyrgyzstan in particular. So he is able to speak and communicate in the languages or in the I guess, concepts and undertones that is more connecting with the populations in outside of urban areas. So this is, I absolutely agree with you. That's something that Atambayev obviously was not able to do, or previous leaders, and something that you know, Tokayev or Mirziyoyev can't do, and Rahmon even. Completely agree with you. I also want to mention that even though he is able to connect with indigenous population, he is and he's very popular still in Kyrgyzstan, despite his, you know, I would say corrupt and autocratic style of governance, even though he has legitimate support in many parts of Kyrgyzstan, he still remains extremely collaborative with Moscow and helps Moscow to retain its influence in Kyrgyzstan. And that can be said about every single leader, maybe with some exceptions of Turkmenistan, but every single leader in Central Asia, that they continue to maintain those patron-client relations or really loyal relations with Moscow, symbolically, and the security sector, political sector. They continue to see benefits from being closely aligned with Russia, despite all the atrocities and brutalities that Russia is waging in Ukraine. And I think this is the big rift that we see emerging in Central Asia, but also especially in Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, where the population is moving on. The intellectual, creative elites and civil society groups are moving on from aligning with Russian colonial narratives and having different imaginaries of what Russia should be, will be, and obviously revising the legacies of Russian colonialism. And the governments are not doing that. The leaders are not doing that. They will allow a little bit of conversation. They will throw a bit of, you know, they will allow a little bit of freedom to maneuver, but they continue to be very loyal. And I'm curious to see where this rift leads us in the years ahead, when the disagreement between the society and corrupt autocrats in Central Asia is really on polar opposites of what they imagined Russia to be. Because I think we notice this kinds of rifts in other parts of post-colonial, other parts of the world where societies grapple with legacies of colonialism, how societies have to deal not only with legacies of colonialism, but also with the leaders who continue to support colonial masters or former colonial masters and kind of replicating their colonial legacies, even if the countries in general, nations received independence. So that would be interesting to see how that contentious issue plays out in the years ahead.
Okay, thank you. We're talking about the decolonial discourse in Central Asia, and my guests are Erica Marat, a professor of political science at the National Defense University in Washington, Azamat Junispah, sociologist and professor at Pfizer College in Claremont, California, and Diana Kudaibergen, a political sociologist from Cambridge University, who will be moving on to the University College of London this autumn. And I want to get into, now I want to get into the Russian legacy, right? When I'm, you know, years ago, when I was working in villages in Central Asia, I always had to go back to Moscow every 8 or 10 weeks for something. And when I would talk to the Russians on the street, they would go on and on about all the great things that Russia gave the Central Asians and how the Central Asians were so much better off from, you know, from having had the Russian influence, I believe was their, Vliania was more their term, that they obviously didn't say kolonizatsiya. Diana, when people are discussing the Russian legacy in Kazakhstan, what's the conversation like? I mean, are people saying, oh, well, we gained so much from being part of Russia? I mean, how does that conversation work when they try to figure out where the Russians where to place the Russians in their own history among the Kazakh people?
Yeah. I wrote a whole book about it. It's coming out this fall. It's called What Does It Mean to Be Kazakhstani? And it's very kind of like self-reflexive decolonial book in a sense that it tries to discuss both the colonial history, but I couldn't go into much detail, so there should be another text on that. And then on what do we do with the type of cleavages, and especially the focus on ethnicity and the scares of inter-ethnic conflict between Russians and Kazakhs that Soviet Union exacerbated, and kind of like, you know, through the archives I trace how they often, you know, even on the party level, they try to really push this agenda that if not for Soviet Union, these two groups of people will kill off each other. And then we see over the 30 years of independence, even though there were some, like, you know, minor conflicts, they were usually, you know, without violence, but obviously there were racisms and so on and so forth. But we don't really see the type of violence that really could break out when an inter-ethnic conflict can happen. So I'm tracing that history and I'm looking into it, you know, from different angles, looking into who are the Russians in Kazakhstan. And it's a very, I was editing the pre-proof stage yesterday, and it's a very kind of like emotional thing to write about it, because our Russians are very different from Russians from Russia. And you can see from all the data collected and the voices of people who are and who were always citizens of Kazakhstan, or who spent, like, you know, have long family history in Kazakhstan, they very much differ from people who come, for example, right now, the recent reallocates, exiles from the war and so on. So you see the huge difference. And I think, again, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Georgia became the type of countries where there were floods of people running away from the draft in the fall of last year, the Russian potential soldiers who didn't want to draft into the army, they ran into Russian young men, I should say, men and young men were running into Kazakhstan. And you could see the drastic difference between our Russians and then the Russians that were coming later and how they tried to belong. And I'm also discussing that in brief in the chapter to show the contrast. But to me, this whole idea of sort of like, you know, that Russians in Kazakhstan or Russians in Central Asia who are our citizens, who are part of our history, who are part of our, you know, again, our state, our society, to see them as colonizers, I think it's the wrong way to put the conversation, because these people or their families and the legacy that they brought were not always, you know, the actual actors of colonization. They were often, you know, the mechanisms. Of course, every single story needs to be tracked, and you know, but I do believe that this type of generalization is kind of very, very problematic. Another issue that often comes up is this idea of sort of that many Kazakhs actually, and that comes back to what Azamat was saying, that many Kazakhs are saying, like, you know, no matter how violent the 20th century was, and again, for us, the 20th century is the Soviet colonization, no matter how violent it was, you know, it brought us a lot of great things. We are educated, we have our opera houses, we have, like, you know, cities, we have civilization, and they don't even understand how colonial this language is. To say that Kazakh nomads or Central Asian nomads or people in pre-colonial Central Asia did not have civilization, that they did not have culture, that they did not have, you know, all of these kind of like categories of basically creating an hierarchy between empire and the colonized, that, you know, we're bringing you all these good things. We are, you know, bringing you the enlightenment, we're bringing you the civilization, the modernization, and so on. I think speaking in that type of language and completely denigrating that your local culture never had any of those things, or never had any kind of similar things to connect to that. We had a fantastic oral history, oral tradition. We had our own forms of literature that may not be considered as forms of literature, for example, in European and colonial context, but they were. So to say that and to denigrate your own culture and your own history, I think is very problematic, but a lot of people still continue speaking in this type of colonial language. Another thing that I think is persisting, and that's something that we really need to tackle, is not all of these kind of like Sovietized stereotypes and, you know, narratives about ethnic conflicts and so on, but we actually need to speak about discriminations, and that discrimination and racism works at multi-leveled layers, and different people are often victims or subjects of this particular racialization and discrimination. To say that Soviet Union did not have race and racism is wrong. It had its own version of racialization that definitely exists, and we still see it in the works of my colleagues who worked on, for example, Central Asian migrants in Russia, particularly in Moscow, how Central Asians are called Chornye. I'm really sorry for that slur, but it's basically they're called blacks. They're called the chair word. I'm not going to pronounce that slur, but it's quite horrible as well. And the way that this type of very racialized and racist language is normalized in Russian context, right? And I'm viewing a lot of sort of discourses in Russian media, how ordinary people can just basically say, oh, I don't want to, you know, rent an apartment here because there's too many Tajiks living here. And then they would use the chair word. And I'm like, you normalize it so much that you even allow yourself to speak like that on the state television. I think this is very, very problematic. But again, this type of racialization, this type of, because colonialism always comes with hierarchy, it always comes with differences, imperial differences. Somebody has to be at the bottom, somebody has to be at the top. The person at the top or the group at the top is always the colonizer, the person or the people in power. And this kind of like hierarchization is something that for me right now is the biggest, one of the biggest problems that we need to fight against. And within this hierarchization, of course, it reproduces all of these false myths and false narratives of sort of like, okay, opera houses are fantastic, but for that we had to pay with millions of deaths of people during the famine of 1933, Ashraf Sholok, right? Or the, I don't know, the cities that were built on the financing or on the resources then on the lands of the former nomads who actually were killed off during the sedentarization because they were completely taken, they were dispossessed of their land, they were dispossessed of their traditional way of living, of their lifestyles. And then, you know, to claim that this type of civilization, this type of, I don't know, culturedness is worth all of these deaths, I think is an incredibly violent way of putting things forward. So whenever people are trying to say, to bring up forward these ideas of sort of like civilizational, we brought you civilization, or the colonial rule in Central Asia was beneficial, or, you know, to consider all of these very strong and big statements and completely forget about all the violent crimes that this land and these people and these societies had to pay for. I mean, like, you know, again, I've been studying these traumas for a very long time. I don't want to call people victims because these are not victims, they are survivors. But the idea, again, bringing this idea that when you're talking about something beneficial, or when you're calling colonization as something great because it brought you civilization, you're completely undermining and erasing the lives, the suffering, the dispossession, and the type of traumas, generational traumas that continue haunting people till today. So that's what I think is the biggest problem with this discourse, with this legacy that we really need to bring forward. And of course, decolonizing means to kind of like get rid of all these kind of like narrative big discourses and the type of knowledge that was really colonizing our mind, as both Erica and Azaman have said, and to get rid of this type of language, get rid of this type of narratives that a lot of people normalize in the everyday language in Central Asia, in Russia, and everywhere else. I mean, there are a lot of people outside Russia and outside Central Asia who are basically saying, like, well, it was great for Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, you know, because they have their own industries now, or that they have their own cities now. And then they compare it to some other states that weren't colonized in the region, right? And I'm not going to go into detail about how racist and how incredibly problematic that type of comparison is also. And to say that somebody is less developed or more backward, and then Central Asian states are more developed in some ways because of colonization, is again deeply problematic. So I think, you know, to me, one of the biggest and most detrimental legacy of that is this type of language and this type of framing that people don't consider being violent, because it is incredibly violent.
Okay, thank you. Azamat, more than a few Russian officials recently have kind of claimed that some of the Central Asian peoples didn't even exist. Now, we remember this from Putin talking like 10 years ago and saying there was no such thing as a Kazakh nation until Nazarbayev came to power in Kazakhstan and brought everybody together. But I mean, more recently, we've seen these kind of comments too. There was a Russian historian that was on television at the start of this year that claimed that the Uzbeks weren't a people, right? But until Russia came and brought them all together. So they seem to be making all these kind of claims about the peoples of Central Asia really didn't exist as a nation until Russia came and helped them form their own nation. Now, you're from Kazakhstan, you're a Kazakh. How does that make you feel when you hear these kind of comments? And how do you think it makes the general population feel when these Russians more frequently all the time make these kind of comments, like they were just, you know, no one lived in northern Kazakhstan. They were just kind of wandering around with no place to live. And it was really Russia coming that actually brought them together as a nation.
Yeah, I think two effects come to mind, or two things come to mind, right? So one is that whenever you hear people from Russia say these things, politicians or talking heads or, you know, journalists, so-called journalists, you think, okay, there really is a long, long way for Russian society to go, right? For them to begin to reckon with their own legacy, with what they have done, with the impact that their actions, their history has had, right? So that the fact that a lot of people, that all they can talk about is this paradigm of development and modernization, and they seem to be trapped in that, it shows that, again, there is a really long way to go. But for people, you know, in Central Asia, when we hear things like that, I think it actually accelerates the process of decolonization, right? Because it makes it impossible to look away, right, from Russia as this colonial power, right, as a brutal colonial power, as an incredibly arrogant colonial power, right? And so, yeah, it shows, when they say that, it shows that Russian society has yet to reckon with its own history as a colonial power, and it speeds things up in Central Asia, in terms of moving away from sort of Russian domination, because people need to recognize Russia for what it is in order to move away. And again, I think a lot of this is specifically for people, for Central Asians who were the comprador class, right? Or who were Russian language, Russian-speaking, Russian-thinking folks, right? So a lot of people who never lost their language, who never lost their culture, they should not be discounted, right? They're a huge part of society. And just my research, the study from last summer, it shows that the discourse about modernization and all that really is not as prevalent when you talk to people who are Kazakh speaking, right? So a lot of this propaganda poison is much more present with Kazakhs in our study who are Russian language Kazakhs and older Russian language.
Okay, thank you. We're getting close to the end. So I'm going to ask a question. I'd like to get comments from all of you on this. How much did Russia's invasion of Ukraine actually propel the decolonial process in Central Asia, in your opinion? Eric, I'll start with you.
So it definitely helped to mainstream those discussions. Decolonial awakening has been going on for a while now. There were decolonial discussions even during the Soviet period and activism. But what happened after February 2022 is those normally siloed or boutique decolonial discussions and practices spilled into the mainstream and found new audiences among people who are not necessarily activists or arts community or in academia. So it was something that has been brewing for a while, and it finally found its outlet in the last couple of years.
Okay, thank you. Azamat?
I think it did a great deal. I think it really propelled it a great deal for the thoroughly Russified, right? For those who were sort of Russian speaking and proud of it, Kazakhs, right? In Kazakhstan, certainly the invasion has become kind of a wake up moment for many, many folks. That's what I'm finding.
Okay, thank you. Diana, you get the last word.
Thank you. I agree with both Erica and Azamat. I think the kind of discussion, the colonial discussion, existed in dissidence in Soviet times as well. And then, again, it's the difference of language, if you want to put it like that. But I've seen from the archival work that in the Kazakh-speaking discourses and writing, it has been very prominent since the 90s, basically. But it found its own platform. People were writing about it quite actively. And then I think it was in Kazakhstan, particularly, was sipping it into the Russified discourse, maybe in the 2000s. And then, with a lot of literature coming into the field, people were first, interested in post-colonial theory and maybe applying how it works in our context. And then when decolonial thought came in, and I'm really grateful to Madina Tlastanova, who was able to write about it in Russian, for example, a lot of people started reading it, and they, I remember speaking. I was a student, and I was interviewing Solya Suleymanova, and she said, you know, it's such a fantastic awakening to finally have the type of language to describe what we've been feeling for our whole lives. And she was born in the 70s. And I think when people got that vocabulary, the way of thinking, the way of dealing, and in practice in particular, because decoloniality in Central Asia is a very practical issue. First, it's decolonial praxis, and then it's decolonial writing or decolonial kind of like conceptualization of what it is. And I think as soon as it entered in this practical aspect, people finally understood what all of them were talking about. The idea of cultural amnesia, the idea of these cultural dispossessions, the idea of traumas, and they just didn't know how to put them into words. But once they had the vocabulary, and now they're taking it forward, they're creating their own language for that. And that's why I think what we started with, this idea that it's a very transnational and transborder movement, is very, very important. That people from different communities in different states and, even states that are not recognized, communities that do not have their own independence yet, the fact that we all participate in this dialogue together, I think, is incredibly important and crucial. But the fact that all of these people who participate in the discussion, in many ways, and maybe some people are still colonized by Russia, some people are semi-colonized by Russia, but the fact that we all experience this colonization tells us a lot. And I'm very hopeful that, you know, these voices will be heard, and that the type of vocabulary they are developing for themselves will also be part of the bigger discourse, kind of a bigger decolonial discourse on a global level. Thank you for this conversation, by the way, and for the opportunity to share the views.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And I hope I have you all back soon to continue this conversation. This is one of these that I could go on and on for a couple hours listening to and asking questions about. But for now, we are out of time. So thank you, Azamat, Diana, and Erica. A big thank you, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mezhelis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mezhelis podcast or the Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thanks, and we'll be back soon. Bye-bye.